What the hell is tax reform anyway?
How do I maximize my super?
How does the exchange rate impact me?
What is negative gearing?
How can I stay out of debt?
What is a housing bubble anyway?
ASX, S&P, WTF?
Welcome to On The Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks and big bickies.
On The Money, serving up finance in one easy bite.
Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out everything that's happening in the world of finance, business and the economy. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On The Money, broadcast through Australia on the Community Broadcasting Network from the studios of Radio 2 SER. This week, we take a look at the negative outlook just issued by international credit rating agency Standard & Poor's, which could affect Australia's AAA credit ratings. And
you're calling up a taxi-like service, but it's just arriving at your house. It's a self-driving vehicle, so it does all this without any human intervention.
We take a look at how new car technologies and concepts are changing the way we think of car ownership today and into the future, and how it could save us money. Also on the show, we speak to a venture capitalist who is financially backing numerous technology startups and how he started himself in this business. But first, today the government had a warning on the economy from the ratings agency Standard & Poor's. An outlook downgrade had both the Treasurer and Shadow Treasurer looking contrite and saying the economy would come good according to their estimates. Meanwhile, Malcolm Turnbull was in Queensland for extensive talks with crossbencher MP Bob Catter and only got the news of the downgrade when he emerged. Ratings agency Standard & Poor's today revised their ratings outlook from stable to negative for Australia, citing questions over political stability after the election. Whilst not a ratings downgrade from AAA, the agency is in effect issuing a warning that Australia should get its books in balance and do something about our burgeoning debt levels. The Prime Minister was taking heed of the warning in a press conference this afternoon.
These are exciting times of great opportunity, but great challenge. S&P has reminded us that budget repair and that responsible public finances are absolutely critical.
AMP's chief economist Shane Oliver said on the ABC this afternoon that it was a warning sign.
Look, it's not the end of the world. The Australian economy kept growing back in 1986 when we last lost our AAA, but it's not a good thing. It shows that we've become a bit of a dumb country, a country that can't control government spending, or at least in a way that's adequately financed, that maybe we've lost our way a little bit, that this consensus that perhaps existed going through the 80s into the 90s about the need for sensible economic policy, the need for keeping the budget deficit under control, has been lost to some degree, and maybe this is a bit of a wake-up call.
And what are the effects of a AAA downgrade anyway? Shane Oliver again.
Think back to 2001. Lots of concern when Standard & Poor's downgraded the US from AAA. And, of course, what happened? Interest rates in the US went down, not up. Likewise, last week, the UK was downgraded, lost its AAA rating. What happened? UK interest rates went down, not up. It all depends on the economic circumstances. So my feeling is that the flow on in terms of borrowing costs in the economy would be relatively modest, if at all. And certainly today, what did the 10-year bond yield? Didn't do much. I think the risk would come. It's more about what it tells us about Australia, that maybe we're not on the right path anymore, and maybe there's a threat potentially for the exchange rate down the track.
In his efforts to put together a viable government, Malcolm Turnbull has just held a lengthy meeting today with lower house crossbencher Bob Catter. Bob Catter announced in a separate press conference in Brisbane that he would be supporting the Turnbull government by guaranteeing supply and passage of money bills to ensure stable government. He cited the agreement over the Gillard years with crossbenchers Oakeshott and Windsor and that this would work. I asked Professor of Politics Clem McIntyre of the University of Adelaide that with seats in doubt leaning towards the government today, how important actually is Bob Catter to the Liberals?
He's one of at least five crossbenchers. I think it looks like there will be no more than five. And if the government falls on 75 seats and needs one more, then any one of those five can talk to the government and try and advance their own local causes. So I think what we're seeing is, as you would expect, Bob Catter's been in the game a long time. He knows how these things work. He sees the opportunity to put the interests of his voters first and foremost as he opens negotiations with the party that's likely to form the government.
Bob Catter said he had 40 points that he was interested in pursuing with the government, and a lot of these had to do with the development in the top end, which he said in an interview with me last year.
Yeah, I mean, the dams on the Ord and Fitzroy and taking that water south from those areas, the big open plains country of Western Australia. We've got the same concepts here in northeastern Australia. We get four of the nation's five biggest rivers, and there's no irrigation being taken out of any of them except for one dam on the Burdekin, and even that's pretty small beer. So that's where we want to go. That's what we want to do. But if they have opened the door with government guarantees, our projects stand up on their own merits. So ethanol is one of the very few. So instead of spending $25,000 million a year to the Middle East, surely it would be better if it was spent in Australia, in regional Australia, and of course that's in northern Australia where the water is.
So you think in northern Queensland it's going to be water based projects that might get the Guernsey?
No, we have a canal project that will open up massive resources, but it gives you a super cheap highway to carry massive amounts of resource, and that's what we want and need to do.
And where would that be going from and to?
Well, at this stage, it's commercial in confidence, and I can't go further than that. But let's just say it's in northeastern Australia.
The degree to which the government can accommodate Bob Catter's views on ethanol, dams and development will depend on whether Scott Morrison will revise his budget. Clem McIntyre again.
Well, I think he will do anyway, regardless of Bob Catter's position, because we know that there is, however the House of Representatives finishes, we know that there is a strange mix in the Senate and a completely new and unpredictable mix of crossbenchers there who are likely to have their own agendas for reform. If the coalition forms government, it's going to need a goodly number of those new senators on the crossbench to align themselves with it and to support their legislation, and they'll each have their own demands. So I think it's going to be an immensely difficult task for a government to make a case for economic reform, because we know the sorts of priorities many of these new senators are bringing to Canberra. There's some scepticism about free trade agreements. There's obviously a lot of interest in Australian procurement, Australian goods first. I think that's going to mean that there's a lot of wheeling and dealing done in relation to passage of budget. So I think Scott Morrison, in a sense, is going to have to sit down, look at the makeup of the new parliament, see what he can and can't achieve, and it's going to be, I think, a fairly circumspect government for a while as it gets a feel for what it can manage in relation to support from the new Senate.
University of Adelaide's Professor Clem McIntyre there ending that report. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money through the Community Broadcasting Network, broadcast from the studios of Radio 2 SER.
My name is François Carrier. I am at the UTS Business School, and you are listening to On the Money, serving up finance in one easy bite.
Well, car sharing, ride sharing, driverless cars. These are all ideas that are being used to describe the future of road transportation. However, they could also have the effect of reducing car ownership by making alternatives to owning a car, or multiple cars, less attractive. So how will this affect the way you use your cars, and what impact will this have on industry? Vincent Su finds out.
For millions of people in Australia and around the world, getting into the driver's seat is a daily ritual, whether it's getting to work, shopping, entertainment or back home. Of course, some people take the train, bus or carpool, but statistics from the 2011 census shows that two-thirds of Australians go to work in a car. This varies from place to place. The lowest is in Sydney at 58%, but that's still high. We love our cars, so it's an uphill battle for any company that promotes the virtues of doing away with one less car in the garage or even foregoing the car entirely. But that's exactly what new companies are doing with concepts like car sharing, Think of it as short-term rentals, ride-sharing, which are like taxis, and driverless cars further into the future. So what does this mean for your car? Jonathan Engler, Communications Director at GoGet, a car-sharing company in Sydney, says a shift in thinking about car ownership is already underway, particularly in densely populated areas where there is also decent public transport.
It's always had a high-density preference. Car share tends to work well when you just have a large number of people sharing the vehicles. Car share requires a really good, healthy public transport and other modes of transport to really thrive, because people need to be confident that they can give up their vehicle. I mean, car share is part of a number of transport options that include public transport, that include even in taxis and cycling and walking.
Jonathan also says that this concept is already helping in reducing direct and indirect costs for individual users.
Because car share exists, because people can go without owning a private vehicle, more than half of our members report that they defer the purchase of a car. So I think from that you can infer that people would, if car share didn't exist, they would have to buy a car. The comparison between car ownership and car share would be at about 10,000 kilometers travel per year, with the car being used about 20 hours per week. And the total amount saved is about $650 a month, plus what we would call hassle time. And that hassle time would be, you don't have to wash the car, right? You don't actually have to fill up on petrol, right? We pay for petrol. You don't have to worry about servicing or the insurance or registration.
And business users too.
You, on an average day, maybe you use 3 cars a day, right? But 5 times a month, you need to use 10 cars. What you don't want to do is have to buy 10 cars. GoGet allows you to meet the demand without buying vehicles.
But in the age of digital disruption, even this relatively new concept probably won't last for long as driverless cars begin to hit our roads. So what will succeed this? Ride-sharing options like Uber as we know it today still have drivers, so it's not driverless. Even though it has made a similar impact as car sharing to the way we think of car ownership. However, a component of ride sharing is being hailed as beginning a transformation into a model that has been dubbed mobility as a service. Brandon Shutley, project manager at the Sustainable Worldwide Transportation Program at the University of Michigan, describes driverless mobility as a service as a kind of hybrid between ride and car sharing today. Here's Brandon.
You're calling up a taxi-like service, but it's just arriving at your house. It's a self-driving vehicle, so it does all this without any human intervention. And so if you're able to use it in that way, of course, you can generally get away with not owning a vehicle yourself.
But Brandon adds that not everyone will want to take advantage of this model.
You still would have a niche for things like very wealthy individuals or corporations owning their own vehicles because they just see the need to have on-demand vehicles, whereas the average person perhaps can get away with having the shared service.
Like GoGet and other existing car ownership alternatives, Brandon says that mobility as a service works best in densely populated areas. But he adds that it changes as soon as you get to more rural areas where there is not as much demand in a small amount of space. Households may need to continue owning cars, but the ownership model will change. Brandon explains how.
It involves sharing without it being a public or mobility as a service, but more within a household where you could, for example, reduce the number of vehicles within a normal family if you have the type of trip patterns that enable you, for example, to take one person to work, but if the car just sits in the parking lot all day long, it travels back home, picks someone else up, runs their errands or other things, and then is back by 5 to pick up the first person and bring them back home. So if your trip patterns and other things allow you to do this, you can, say, go from 2 cars to 1. Of course, you're increasing vehicle usage per vehicle.
However, Jonathan Engler from GoGet warns that the personal ownership model under driverless cars could lead to more problems, not less, in cities.
The important thing to recognize is that if the world of the future is autonomous vehicles, but they're all privately owned autonomous vehicles, then you don't really solve the problem that is caused by private ownership of cars, which is the congestion problems, etc., the waste of resources.
Jonathan says that his company has already begun preparing for a driverless future.
We've begun research already. About 2 years ago, we joined forces with UNSW to launch Ethel the Yaris, the robot car.
So overall, which model will win out? Brandon Shutley at the University of Michigan gives his take.
Well, this is, of course, one of the big questions, whether or not the predominant model will still be the traditional personal individual vehicle ownership or family type ownership, or whether it will be more of the mobility as a service or shared vehicles. So this is, of course, something people are keeping their eye on and really paying attention to where things are going in the near future.
So whether it's mobility as a service or ownership, there are a few things we can be certain of with driverless cars. One that we can be certain of is that personal ownership will decrease. So what does this mean for car makers and their sales? Brandon is skeptical of a decrease in overall car sales.
I would be surprised if sales and other things ultimately on the whole went down, because even if you're not owning a vehicle, if you're calling it up, let's say Uber or whoever the company may be, they still need to purchase and own the vehicle. And if you're using them as a form of public transportation, these vehicles will, of course, as a modern taxi does, get an incredible amount of usage every year. But even if you keep it to the personal level where your family still owns your vehicle, but you've gone from two down to one, and a husband and wife or someone can share a vehicle, that vehicle will likely get at least double the amount of mileage on it. That stands to reason that you would ultimately have more vehicles and more mileage. It just may be that they're not owned by you or me, but they're owned by some companies who are offering up the service.
In other words, the turnover of vehicles increases due to more wear and tear.
Instead of owning a vehicle for X number of years, you maybe own it for half of those number of years, so you're buying vehicles twice as frequently.
What about making vehicles more durable instead? Brandon says that we just don't know. We need to wait to see what happens in practice to see whether more turnover or more reliability is the better model. So overall, will driverless cars save us money?
There's big hopes that it will save on insurance, because if these vehicles are as safe as they promise to be, or even nearly as safe as they promise to be, the frequency and severity of accidents will drastically drop. So insurance will become much more unnecessary, maybe not completely unnecessary, but less of a feature of driving as it is today. And so, of course, if you don't own a vehicle, you're reducing that cost. These vehicles, hopefully, too, will drive more efficiently than your average human driver, which saves gas and fuel, whichever it may be, not gas, but electricity or whatever your fuel might be.
Hello, this is Saul Leslake, and you're listening to On The Money.
So, a big change for industry, but hopefully the future of a more convenient and cheaper road transport. That was Brendel Schottel ending that report by Vincent Hsu. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On The Money, broadcasting nationwide on the Community Broadcasting Network. Well, startups have been in the news as a saviour to the economy, but when you're starting a new business from an idea, there is a lot you need to do. Venture capitalists with experience in startups would be just the person you would need. And Benjamin Chong is just that person.
Look, I'm very fortunate. I have been really lucky since the mid-90s to have started a number of technology businesses. Not all of them have been successful, but I have been through the process of starting, growing, buying and selling businesses. And over the last recent years, I have spent the money that I've been fortunate to have made to invest in businesses, and I've also had a number of investors give me their money to invest on their behalf. So my experiences are based on getting dirt under my fingernails and actually knowing what it is like to grow and scale a business.
And now you're helping other businesses start up?
Indeed.
Is there a way that you have to teach people how they approach investors and how they deal with investors? Is that something that people need to be trained to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Because while I think some things come to us naturally, being able to understand the investor perspective is critical. And I would suggest, as an investor, if you're going to be putting money into the share market, you know that if you put money in, you can actually take it out by selling it with your online broking account or online trading account or even your telephone broker. Usually, in a very early stage business, you're putting money into a private company, and there is not much of an aftermarket for the shares that you own in that company because it is a private company. Now, as an investor, we're looking at what is the return we can make on the dollar that we put in this business. Is it going to grow 5 times, 10 times, 20 times? And one of the things that we do teach founders is that as a rule of thumb, the earlier stage a business is, the larger a multiple of a return that the investor is wanting to get. And as a venture capitalist, we'd love to see returns that are 100 times what we put in. If we put a dollar, we'd love to get $100 out. At the minimum, if we put a dollar in, we'd love to get 10 or 20 times out. So that's the kind of mindset that a founder needs to consider if they're going to be taking money from external investors. Do they have the skills? Do they have the market potential? Do they have the possibility of growing this business 100 times?
And so when you look at TV shows like Shark Tank, yes, you know, where you're meeting these big entrepreneurs and so forth, should you think of things in that way? I mean, are you expecting people to perhaps have some expertise which they may give you as an investor?
Absolutely. So when we have a look at shows like Shark Tank, quite often those sharks are very, very wily and wise business people who have got contacts, they've got networks, they've got the ability to add value. So as a potential founder who is seeking investment, money is one thing, which is fantastic, but thinking about what are the other things the investor can bring to the party, whether it's opening their Rolodex, whether it is helping with advice, whether it is being able to introduce or refer new members of the team to that business, they're going to be very valuable things to help increase the chance of success for that founder.
So an investor could be a real asset because they could see that, you know, perhaps, well, look, you know, you need some help on the accountancy side or something.
Absolutely.
Let me put you in touch with blah, blah, blah.
Indeed.
Who can come in 2 days a week and relieve you of the burden of worrying about how you're going to do your books for the end of the month for the bank or something.
Exactly. Very few founders, in fact, very few of us are good at absolutely everything in the world, and therefore finding complementary investors, perhaps with experience in areas where you might be less familiar with, is a boon.
So is the scale of the business or the idea something that you look at? Because obviously some things are going to need like $1 million, other things are going to need 10,000. Is that something you look at to start off with?
Yeah, I think one of the things to consider, whether you're an investor or you're just an interested party, is how big is this business going to be? Is this a business that is going to be a lifestyle business, which is going to generate a great income for the founders or the founding team? Or is this possibly a business that may have international customers and is going to have many, many customers, thousands or tens of thousands of customers around the world? And typically, those larger businesses require more funding.
Mm. And of course, the question of whether you're starting here or whether you're automatically in a worldwide market also makes a difference too, I would imagine.
Absolutely. So investors, generally speaking, like to find entrepreneurs who have big ideas and whose big ideas can actually have customers from around the world. Australia's a wonderful country. There's about 24 million of us here. But by the time you start segmenting the market, and we say even segment it by gender or segment it by age, that 24 million becomes a lot smaller. And obviously, someone who has a product that can service a much larger number of customers, even in the English-speaking world, could have many, many more sales.
And so, you know, what if you're looking at it from the point of view that, well, let's try the idea in Australia and then maybe we can sell it to some wealthy Americans.
Well, that's certainly something that a number of very successful entrepreneurs have done. They've used Australia as a test market to see if their concept actually has legs, to see whether there are customers for it. And then on the back of that early success, they've been able to grow that overseas.
Is our position in the Asia Pacific region a benefit for us here? I mean, being in the same time zone often helps.
I think that is the great opportunity that Australia has ahead. We have Western roots, but we are in the same time zone as over 60% of the world's internet population. So I was in Singapore last week and I met with a number of startups there at various stages of the life cycle. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be amazing if more Australian companies took advantage of people who are coming onto the internet, immediately onto mobile devices, folks who are in countries where the average GDP per capita is rising significantly, where there are masses of middle-class folks who desire to get access to new goods and services. I think that it's a tremendous opportunity for us to bridge that gap between East and West.
Food for thought for those of you considering starting up a business with your great idea. Benjamin Chong and people like him are out there. I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to On The Money, broadcast across the nation on the Community Broadcasting Network from the studios of Radio 2SER. Well, that's all we've got for you tonight on The Money. We hope that you'll tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about money, finance and business. Thanks to producer Vincent Su and executive producer Catherine Zengerer. You can find out all about our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser and you can find us on Facebook as well. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you all the inside running on things financial. Thanks for your company.